This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us today. On today's edition of the show, we're devoting the hour to interviews about fathers and sons. We begin by revisiting my conversation with musician Dweezil Zappa, son of innovative rock pioneer Frank Zappa. Although Dweezil has created a catalog all his own, he joined me back in 2011 to discuss his Grammy Award-winning band, Zappa Plays Zappa, a group devoted to paying homage to his late father. He joined us to discuss what it's like to be the son of the groundbreaking rock and roll legend. Let's take a listen. I know this band has been around for a couple of years now. Mm-hmm. You've been touring the country. Do you feel you've made some progress on getting a new audience for your dad's music, but also a new appreciation for what he was doing?
I think since 2006, when this started, we've definitely seen a change in the type of person that comes to the shows. In the initial first tour, it was mostly men over 60.
I was going to say old guys,
yeah.
Right?
And, you know, sometimes they'd bring their kids and you'd see the occasional straggling girlfriend, you know. But you know, since we've been doing it for a while and we've played all kinds of different places all over the world, we've done festivals and all kinds of things, the age range has come way down, and we do see a lot more college age kids and younger, and we see a lot more women, and it's actually you know, really great to see a new sort of energized audience out there picking it up and experiencing it for themselves, you know, because the reality is Frank's music is not nostalgia music. It's
not
very contemporary. In fact, some of it is still so ahead of its time that, you know, it's still yet to be totally appreciated. And you know, that's why we do what we do.
It's a tribute band, and that's an important word to use. And I was reading in some of the things that you've said about this band, and even in preparation for putting it together, mm-hmm. it was important to play Frank Zappa's music correctly. Does that mean note for note?
Well, it does, but what people have to understand is that, you know, Frank had a very clever way of creating his music. In a lot of ways, the best concept for people to understand is that even when he had complex compositions that he would write, he would create it in a way where there's a theme. There's a very structured element that you have to adhere to. I mean, he's writing classical music, but then he would also have these expansive moments where you could improvise. So the challenge as a musician is twofold: the dedication and discipline to play the correct parts that are as written, and then the challenge to improvise and create something that's musical and that you can connect with an audience. And then come back and go back to the theme. So a lot of his music is written to be that way. And as a musician, it's the greatest challenge, and it's also the most rewarding experience.
I do want to play Peaches in Regalia, your sure. version of that. But I should just say that how hard was it to get a band that not only works together but has the skills, the talents, the sort of sensibility to understand your dad's music? Was that a challenge
it was for you? It was difficult, but I mean, I made very difficult auditions specifically to weed out people that were delusional, because you know, it's a big waste of time for people to come in and pretend they have this great pedigree. You know, a lot of people would come to try to audition for Frank's bands just so they could put it on their resume, because then people would say, "Oh, you must be good. You auditioned for Zappa," you know. And it's there was an element of that when we were mm-hmm. trying to put the band together. You mean people that really, like I said, were delusional and had greater ideas of themselves than their actual commensurate skills would represent.
And the idea was to do Frank's music, not your version of Frank.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, the distinction I always make is, you know, people say, oh, this is just a cover band or a tribute band. I said, well, technically an orchestra is a cover band or a tribute band because they're playing music they didn't write. But the level of skill and artistry that's associated with an orchestra is that's the finest achievement you can, create as a musician. You know, that's what you aspire to be, right? So people think, oh yeah, the orchestra, they're the best. But, you know, to play this music, it's very, very difficult, and you have to have a strong background to do it well and do it with respect to the intent of the composer, you know. So I never go out there and take a piece of music and rearrange it from the ground up and change the harmonies around and do all this other stuff that other people tend to do, especially when you cover rock music. Sure. Or pop music. People say, oh, you got to make it your own. But you don't do that with Beethoven or Mozart. You don't, you know, have some rapper come and go, yeah, yeah, Bach in the house, yeah. You know, I mean, you don't do that. There was no reason to do that, you know, and you shouldn't do it with Frank's music.
Well, that's a perfect segue into your version of Frank Zappa's Peaches in Regalia. Actually comes from his 1969 album, Hot Rats.
Mm-hmm.
And this is you and your group performing. Let's listen.
The rolling this will be 18. Get that groove going.
Should say that's Peaches in Regalia, and it's our guest Dweezil Zappa actually playing with his dad, because Your dad is on tape there.
Yeah, what I did on that version was I actually played along with the master recording from Hot Rats, and I played a lot of the parts that were written to be played on, you know, either some organ or horns. I played them all on guitar and engineered them to sound in the same sort of range as those instruments would live, but it's all done on guitar.
Wow.
And there's some other elements in there that you know, you don't hear on the original. Like there's a little bass solo that Frank played that's not on the original. But what people don't know about that song, most people think, oh, that's one of Frank's shorter, you know, craftier little tunes. But what's funny is the master tape, you know, the front section of the song is one thing, and then it had like an 8-minute blues jam in it, and then it had the outro of the song. So you never heard the 8-minute blues jam that was in there. He put the whole thing together as a short little piece.
And just to add to that, Peaches in Regalia is something that he wrote when you were born or about was that your nickname? Or?
Well, I mean, the album was dedicated to me in 1969. You know, that's the year I was born. So, nice. You know, a lot of that material had been written right around that time.
And did you play? I mean, did your dad teach you directly how to play guitar? I know he began as a drummer.
Yeah, I sat and played with him. You know, when I first started getting interested in playing the guitar seriously, he would show me some things. But at that time, Steve Vai was in Frank's band, and Frank asked Steve to show me some things as well. So I had some pretty good tutoring from the beginning there.
And your dad also just saved, I guess, everything he ever recorded, and it sounded like he recorded most everything he did.
As much as he possibly could. So, you know, a lot of live shows were done multi-track. You know, he's one of the few artists that, especially early on, fought record companies, won the rights to his own recordings, and had his own master tapes in his possession. And he worked independently and released records independently. So archival processes are pretty challenging because we have thousands of tapes. And there really is no archival format that is a universal format. At a certain point, some of them are not going to be playable.
Is it hard to rebel against nonconformist parents?
Well, I mean, I always joke saying the only way that I could rebel in my family was to become a lawyer or an accountant, you know. So, or
any
the worst.
Of that?
No.
No.
No. The worst thing ever would be like a record company A&R person. Mm. So, but. But yeah, so that was never a problem.
Do you play your dad's instruments?
I do, but not on tour, you know, because if something were to happen, that, you know, it's just not a good idea to bring those out there. But yeah, they're fantastic instruments and pretty, you know, unique.
We close out my 2011 interview with Dweezil Zappa by listening to one of my favorite songs by his father, Zombie Woof, from his 1973 album, Overnight Sensation. You're listening to the Fathers and Sons edition of Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with another musician continuing the tradition of his father, Femi Kuti. Stay with us.
Just about as evil as you could be.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In our last segment, we listened to Frank Zappa's son, Dweezil, describe his life as the son of a musical legend. For Femi Kuti, his father's legacy not only includes an acclaimed musical legacy, but a political one as well. Fela Kuti, the originator of the Nigerian funk music called Afrobeat, was also a political leader of sorts in his country, where he openly defied the oppressive government. Those were big shoes to fill, but Femi Kuti has been up to the challenge. He's added his own flavor to the Afrobeat genre, as well as continuing his fight for human rights as an ambassador for Amnesty International. He joined me in the studio earlier this year. I'm curious about your band, Positive Force. You began it, what, almost 30? We were doing the math before the show began, almost 30 years ago.
Yes, the band was formed in 1986, December the 13th.
My. And why is it called Positive Force?
Because at that time I left my father, and everybody was so upset with me, and I wanted them to know it was for positive reasons. And But this took them like nearly a decade to really accept my reasons for leaving, because my father was so huge, and it's like a big taboo. You never go against your family in Africa. And when I made that kind of move, it was like, how dare you? Uh-huh. And then not just an ordinary family, this is Fela Kuti. So it was, I mean, it was hell for me for like a decade.
And how did your father feel about it? Did he feel the same way?
Yes, he was very upset at the uh-huh. beginning. It took him about 6 years to get it off his mind. But I never, I mean, the day I turned back, I decided to just take that route. And it was a very big decision in my mind. But I really believed in what I was doing. And I knew I had to. I never wanted to be, I mean, I was being groomed to be my father, to take, I wore clothes like him, shoes like him, dressed like him. And I just never really felt comfortable. I wanted to be me. I wanted my pain. I wanted my suffering. I wanted my success. I didn't want the final outcome mm-hmm. of being like a copycat of my father. And if I was going to be a failure, I wanted to be the failure in my own doing, not because looking in my old age and saying, oh, my father's at fault or this is at fault. I wanted to make my move. Even if I was going to fail, I knew it was very possible that it was the wrong move, but I had to take that move.
Were you scared? Scared to leave that world of your father?
I loved my father, so I wasn't scared. And I didn't like a lot of things going on in his organization. I thought people took too much advantage of him, and this really hurt me a lot. I mean, we're on tour, people abused his sincerity, people abused his love, and when you love your father and you see all this going on around, it hurts you, and I couldn't bear to... I'll give an example. We're on tour, and his band, people he tours with, we'll just take towels from the hotel. Then the hotel management comes down crying, where are my towels? Wow. This happened so many times on the road. In France, there was a tour we had in Toulouse, and the manager of the hotel stopped the bus, and he said, they have stolen all his towels. And my father said, no, it couldn't be him. Stop, this is racism. And he said, okay. And this was a big problem. So he says, he insists he wants his towels back. So my manager asked his tour manager to check the bags of...
The suitcases of all the musicians.
And then they did see towels. You know, it was very embarrassing. And my father was so upset. And, you know, he was never like this. But everybody kept doing things they were not supposed to do, like fighting in the hotel, breaking up the hotel. Then he had all this... I mean, he was touring. The first tour he went in Berlin was he toured with like 73 people. Then he cut his band down to 43. And these are people who, I mean, they arrived Europe or America and they were just like overwhelmed. And I mean, these are people that were at a very big disadvantage in Nigeria. I could understand the problem, but then if you did love my father and understood what he was doing, you wouldn't arrive places like this and give him a bad image. So, and this fell back on him. Nobody will say it was Fela's band. Everybody just says Fela, and you are his child or his daughter, his son. You feel that pain because you want the success of your father or mother, so to say. So this really hurt me, and it got to a point where I just had enough. I couldn't go on the road with them anymore.
Do you run a tight ship yourself?
Very, very. I mean, everybody knows. I mean, even with my band, they tried this a couple of times, but they knew where I stood, and I would dismiss you immediately. If you were caught wrongly, mm. I had to get rid of you.
How old were you when you started playing alto sax?
Wow. I was 16 going 17.
Oh.
Yes.
I mean, a teenager. I wasn't like you were a five-year-old playing
sax. No, but I started at 8, and he gave me his trumpet at that time because he stopped playing the trumpet. But he gave me the trumpet with no teacher. So I just had the trumpet. His cousin taught me the scale of C major, and then he disappeared. And there was nobody else again, so I dropped the sax. Then he happened to pick up the saxophone, my father, and then I he asked me one day, I came back from school, do you want to play the sax? I said, yes, I want to play the sax. So he gives me a sax, of course, with no teacher as well.
But was he? Did he become your teacher, or you just
no,
you taught yourself?
He got his band leader, who heads the Egyptian Babani, to teach me. He taught me for 2 weeks. But my mother was very upset because she wanted me to go to school in England like he did. She wanted me to get the best education, and he didn't want me to have, so to say, the colonial kind of education. So he wanted me to go to Ghana. So there was this big fight in the family. Mm-hmm. I want my son to go to England. No, he must go to Ghana. Then, unfortunately, I ended up going nowhere. So I bought myself a saxophone tutor, and this was how I started.
Well, I do want to play one of your songs. This is from a 2011 album. This is Africa for Africa. This is for our listeners. So we've been talking a little bit about your music and a little bit about your life. And let's listen to this song, Africa. Femi Kuti's song Africa for Africa from his 2011 album. And I mean, you know, those horns, the rhythms, it's so contagious. Don't you think?
Thank you. Contagious.
In the best sense of that word.
I understand. I never had that description before with my music.
Oh, really?
But thank you.
Well, I hope you're not taking it as an insult, because
no,
I did not mean it that
not,
way
no,
at all.
No.
Only because we're sitting here listening to it, and you can't not move.
Thank you. It's the objective, really. So
you're political, clearly, but not as confrontational as your father.
You agree
with that?
No, at all.
Not at all?
At
okay.
all. I think I'm probably as, but you cannot compare my time with my father's time. My father's time was in the 70s and 80s, where he was confronting, and he was the only voice in Nigeria, and you could even say Africa, apart from people like Mandela, but he wasn't a musician. He was locked up, so he was silenced. Kwame Nkrumah was overthrown. Lumumba was killed. So he was the only voice, and he paid a very high price at this time, and he opened the door of freedom of speech for us in Nigeria. So when I speak today, of course, it would be very hard to arrest me. But I have had my own threats and things like this. And people say I don't mention names. If you check my songs, there's no name I've not mentioned. These new songs are right there. So I think people, because of what my father did, people misjudge me. But this does not upset me, because I do understand my father's story. And of course, I understand my story too. And so if somebody hasn't made or done their research properly, then I'm forced to educate him or her. And then, but I believe I am as confrontational. And then I did participate in my father's life, like for example, taking the mock coffin of his mother to the headquarters of the presidential palace. I was there on that day. I was arrested several times in my father's house because I moved away from my mother. I ran away from my mother to move with my father. So I spent 6 years with my father. And at this time, I was part of many of the beatings and the arrest that went on. So people don't really know my story. What is the difference between my father and I? I'm more of a quiet person.
A quiet person.
Yes. Like my father can't sleep without a lot of noise. I need peace and quiet around me. I hate so many people making noise. My father could not sleep without hearing all this chaos. So we're very different, yet very similar.
There was an election recently in Nigeria. You have a new president, President Buhari. I was doing some research on him.
Yes.
He organized a coup in 1983.
Yes.
But he also was behind your father's arrest at that time.
Yes.
Sentenced to something like 5 years in...
10 years.
10 years in prison.
Yes.
He was then overthrown a couple of years later.
By Babangida, yes.
And was your father then released from prison?
Yes,
after
because
that?
The judge confessed that Buhari instructed him to jail my father, even though he, the judge, appealed that my father was not guilty. But the instruction came from directly from Buhari that he must jail my father, and he went to plead with my father in prison. And they sent him to one of the worst prisons in Nigeria, up north, Maiduguri, where you have the Boko Haram right now. So they believed if they sent him there because of the fanatical attitude of religion, probably he would not even survive. So he was sent there for many reasons. And so, but I think the judge understood what was happening, went there, apologized. And unfortunately, my father, he has a very big mouth. He doesn't know how to keep a secret. So as soon as the judge apologized, he quickly sent for his brother. He told one of the wardens to please send, go back to Lagos, and he needs to see his brother. His brother would pay his transportation. So the warden went, my brother, father's brother came back, saw him, and quickly told him what happened, what the interaction. The judge never denied in public or to anybody. He did apologize, and it was all over. So as soon as the coup happened, Babangida, this was the reason Babangida had to release my father. Oh. And then the judge was dismissed.
You played a place called, or there's a place, I guess, in Lagos called, is it The Shrine or Shrine?
The Shrine.
The Shrine. I mean, it's where your dad played, right?
Yeah, but it wasn't. The Shrine we play now is somewhere, the Shrine we built is the new Shrine we built in honor of my father. And we expanded it to be a place where it's a shrine, where it's for great Africans who have fought for the emancipation of Africa. So it's a place where we pay homage to people like great names I've mentioned, Thomas Sankara, my grandmother, Mandela, people like this, and we pay homage to them. So it's a shrine,
yeah.
My father, people like this. And but the old shrine, my father was tricked. He thought he bought the land, so he built on it. Apparently it was a lease. And when he said to have all these problems with the government, as usual, the government got to the landowners, and he was in court till he died. And they wanted their land back. And he never knew, through his management or somebody around him, mm-hmm. he thought he bought it, and he was tricked into it being a lease. And so he was in this battle till he died. Now the law in Nigeria says the disease cannot, you cannot take the battle of the disease on land issues. So when the disease dies, you automatically lose that case. Nobody. So the land.
So once he died, that was
the end of the case. So
wow.
We tried to talk to the landowners too, please, because he's such a great man. We love it. It's going to be a great tourist center. Blah blah blah. They completely refused. So this convinced my elder sister and myself that the government was involved in trying to frustrate us. So we got this deal with Universal Records to license my father's back catalog. So I was like my mother's favorite, so because
you were your mother's favorite?
Kind of. Everybody says I am, so I probably am.
That's what your sister says, right?
Yeah, that's what they say. So I believe she is my father's favorite, right? So right. We have this big argument, and so they got me to convince my mother to, because she inherited a large chunk of this money, because she was still legally married. So she didn't want anything. She wanted to move back to England, but I managed to convince her that, look, we need to use this money to build the shrine for my father. Okay. And then I managed to convince her. So probably somewhere secretly, somewhere.
Interesting.
And then we build this big place. It's about 5 times bigger than the old place, so it's very huge. And so we managed to build the shrine.
Your father, he died in 1997.
Yes.
Right. Died of AIDS.
Yes.
Which I guess was in the sort of, you know, the really sort of the earlier parts of of that horrible disease.
Yes.
He knew he had AIDS?
No.
He didn't know?
No.
What did he think he had? Do you know?
What did he think he had? I think he thought he was going through some kind of transition. he really believed in spiritual matters. So I think he felt probably God was transforming his body, or probably what he was trying to tell us is, yes, I'm dying and I'm transcending into another level of human life or something. And probably we couldn't understand what he was saying, probably. I would not be able to tell you directly exactly what he was saying, but he was always on from a long time before this disease. He was always talking about spiritual development. I mean, these were the kind of conversations I had secretly with my father. We were always talking about higher forms of life and is it possible for life outside planet Earth and things like this. And we strongly believed in this, and we tried to use the African culture and tradition to express what were they doing in Egypt, what were the pyramids about, etc. What was education in Africa about? It was about higher form of life. Of we knew we were animals and we had to understand we had to develop to be human beings, but then there was another stage of spiritual development and blah blah blah. So probably he knew that, okay, I might be dying and I'm transcending to something outside this life.
We close out my interview with Femi Kuti by listening to a song by his father, Coffin for Head of State. Femi Kuti made reference to the events that inspired this song. Fela's mother was killed during a government raid of his compound. In an act of defiance, he and his family and followers brought her coffin to the gates of the government's army barracks and demanded that his late mother be instated as the president of Nigeria. This is the Fathers and Sons edition of Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from two generations of Hollywood royalty, Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez. The Fathers and Sons edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We turn now to my interview with a father and son who have both distinguished themselves as preeminent members of the entertainment industry, Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez. They joined me in 2011 to discuss their collaboration on the film The Way, in which the son directed the father. They talked about their relationship, their other famous kin, Charlie Sheen, and what it's like working together on a movie. Let's take a listen. You know, there's a line in it where that you speak, Martin Sheen, that you wrote, Emilio Estevez. Our children are the very best and the very worst of us. And I scribbled that down because I thought it was true.
Right, yeah.
And also very moving and profound.
Right. Yes, I think as parents, we have that legacy in front of us. You know, we're always trying to protect our children. We know it's impossible. We still do the best we can. And, you know, from the time they start walking, we have to open the door for them and allow them their freedom. Otherwise, they'll sneak out through the window, you know, and who knows what's going to happen.
And they may do that anyway.
They may do that anyway.
I did plenty of that, sneaking out the window.
What was your relationship like growing up?
Well, it was pretty typical. However, what my parents insisted on is that the family stay together. So when my father would get a job, whether it was local, and what I mean local is in the States, he would insist that the family go. So we'd pile in the country squire station wagon, and off we'd go to Colorado or Wyoming or West Virginia. And if it was abroad, to Europe, he always insisted that the company provide six tickets. And I think what my parents believe that for the family to stay together, they actually had to physically stay together.
Wow.
And as a result, I had a wonderful opportunity to see the world. It wasn't always the most extraordinary places, but they were always the most extraordinary experiences.
You know, I have to say, I couldn't help but think about your son, Charlie Sheen, who's going through some really difficult times in a very public way.
None of my children are very far away from my heart. And in fact, those that are experiencing the most difficult times are the closest. They need the most love at that time, and Charlie's no exception. Mm-hmm. It's no secret that Charlie was having some difficult times, and he's a great supporter, and he's looking great, and he's on and to new projects, and I just embrace him as always and love him. And
seems like he's walking a new Camino.
There would you say so?
New path. Yeah. It seems, yeah.
It's tough, though. I mean, tough coming back from these problems, addiction, things like that.
And to do it publicly, he's a very gutsy guy. He has a great deal of courage, and I admire him tremendously.
You know, he was roasted recently on Comedy Central, and you did a kind of a promo spot with him.
Yeah, he asked me to do it. He wrote it for the two of us to do, and I was delighted. I didn't see the roast itself because, we were on the road, so I missed it.
We were in Dayton that night.
We were in my hometown, Dayton, Ohio, yeah.
But it has some apocalypse references and, you know, all of that.
Well, you know, all that belonged to him, and he's welcome to it. I adore him, and I was grateful. I've never, ever once turned any of my children down for any request that that I could help him with, and that was no exception.
And was this a spiritual journey for you, Emilio?
Well, sure. I mean, the film is, you know, I often say the proof isn't just in the pudding, it's in the eating of the pudding. You know, I'm not interested in making movies about killing people anymore. I'm not interested in making films that are vulgar. You know, that's the low-hanging fruit. And we talk about cynicism and we talk about pessimism and, you know, politicians and the media goes there too. We're all guilty because it's easy. And I invite all of us, I invite the conversation to take a limb, right? Climb up into that tree and taste the fruit. It's sweeter and the view's better.
Martin Sheen, when did you want to be an actor? How young were you?
Oh, gosh, I have no memory of ever not being an actor. I didn't know what it was at the time. You know, I didn't have language or experience, but I knew there was something living inside of me which was, helping me to identify myself. And it was only when I started going to the movies, I guess I was around the age 5 or 6, and gradually in the movies it dawned on me, oh, you're one of those people up on screen.
Really?
Oh, well, that's it. Never mind. Fine. And I was happy as Larry. And it was a tremendous revelation, extraordinary. And I knew that I would never be happy if I didn't pursue this thing, this energy. It possessed me, and it gave me a possession of myself. So that's been a presence my entire conscious life.
Did you have to convince your parents? This goes back, of course, a number of years, but did you have to convince them that you had this passion to be an actor?
My mother died when I was 11, and so, my father had this, you know, he's from Spain, you may know. In fact, he grew up in a little village called Bararrubias in Salta Revolta, which is just about 80 kilometers from Santiago de Compostela, so he was old world and a dear, dear man. I adored him, but it was difficult to get him to realize where I was at that time. I had no intention of going to college. He was insisting I go. I took an entrance examination to the University of Dayton, and I threw it on purpose, trying to tell him that I did. Yes, I still hold the record, I'm told. Out of a possible 100, I got a 3, which I'm not proud of, but it made the point. And my dad finally realized, well, it's wasting his time trying to, talk me into going to college. So I went to New York when I was 18. And it wasn't until I left and committed myself to my dream that he blessed me. Up until then, he just thought I was a lunatic. Well, he got that part right. But, I mean, I had a vision, you know. And he became my biggest supporter.
I was going to say, was he proud?
Oh, God, yes. The only thing that disturbed him was that I had changed my name. I hadn't changed it officially. You know, my name is Ramon.
Estevez.
Yeah, Estevez. And that's still my name. But I created Martin Sheen because it made it, I thought, a bit easier to get along in the profession over in New York. I was in New York at the time, and was involved in the theater.
Emilio, your dad was talking about changing his name.
That's right.
You obviously
have
claimed that name, right. or held on to the name.
Right.
Is that just a different time?
Well, sure, again, this was 1979 when I made the choice to jump in and start doing this as a profession. And my agents at the time and managers who were romancing me, said and me them, said, hey, how about you change your name because you don't look Latino? And again, 1979, 1980, it still would have been somewhat difficult. But he imposed his will, as fathers often do to their sons, and said,
"This
and
guy
he,
over here, yeah, right? Okay."
And said, "Don't make the same mistake I did." And in fact, the first headshot that I had made up, I had Emilio Sheen on it, and it looked just so stupid. It looked terrible, and I knew that was a false note. And I went back to.
But did you also want to make your own way?
I did.
Not be the son
I
of
did,
Martin
yeah.
Sheen.
I did. Yeah, I thought. And then once I started working, I would always, and I saw my name in print, then it would always say right afterwards, parenthetically, Martin Sheen's son. I thought, wow, okay. Well, they're going
to
say that anyway.
Right,
I'm
going to
have to live
right,
with that, right?
Right. Well, I know that, Martin Sheen, this has probably been done to you more than you care, but nonetheless, I did rewatch the very beginning of Apocalypse Now, just because it's iconic at this point. And I do want to play just a small scene. We hear helicopters. We hear the music from the Doors. We see you as a young man lying on a bed, and there are just all these various images. We see the overhead fan, and you are Captain Benjamin Willard. You're awaiting your mission in a Vietnamese hotel during the Vietnam War, 1979.
Saigon. I'm still only in Saigon. Every time I think I'm going to wake up back in the jungle. When I was home after my first tour, it was worse. I'd wake up and there'd be nothing. I hardly said a word to my wife until I said yes to a divorce. When I was here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle. I'm here a week now, waiting for a mission, getting softer. Every minute I stay in this room, I get weaker. And every minute Charlie squats in the bush, he gets stronger. Each time I looked around, the walls moved in a little tighter.
Wow, I don't know what that's like for you to listen to that. It is,
I haven't heard that for quite a while.
It's absolutely frightening, and your voice is so exhausted. It's so depleted and empty.
Well, that's a reflection of the character. You know, this guy was a professional hitman for the Army, and you know, you've got to be in a very, very dark place. You know, I've heard it said, who dies first, the assassin or the assassinated? And the saying is, the assassin, because you have to be dead in order to kill.
Yeah. This was a tough time in your life as well.
Yeah,
right?
Sure. Yeah.
I do want to play another clip, and I have to say, when we posted on our Facebook page that you two were going to be here, including you, Martin Sheen, we got several presidential comments, and I'm sure because you played Josiah Bartlett.
Yes.
Yes,
of course.
And
yeah.
President of the United States in The West Wing, and I want to play a scene where you are angry, and this is after the funeral of Mrs. Langenham. She was your assistant, and she died, and you are angry at God. Let's listen
yes.
to this.
There's a tropical storm that's gaining speed and power. They say we haven't had a storm this bad since you took out that tender ship of mine in the North Atlantic last year. 68 crew. You know what a tender ship does? Fixes the other ships. Doesn't even carry guns. Just goes around, fixes the other ships, and delivers the mail. That's all it can do. Gracias, Tibiago Domine. Yes, I lied. It was a sin. I've committed many sins. Have I displeased you, you feckless thug? 3.8 million new jobs, that wasn't good. Bailed out Mexico, increased foreign trade,
30 million new acres of land for conservation. Put Mendoza on the bench. We're not fighting a war. I've raised three children. That's not enough to buy me out of the doghouse. Hey, credo mi deo pio. Adeo justo. Adeo shito.
And that's a scene from The West Wing. It's a very wow. powerful scene, and you are in the cathedral,
National Cathedral,
and you're
having it out. With the Almighty.
It's a very feckless thug.
Feckless thug. Nothing personal, Lord.
Have you ever been that mad at God?
Oh God, yes, of course. You know, it's Job, isn't it?
It's Job.
You know, Job rages at what's befallen him, and then he turns back up and says, "On the other hand, thanks a lot for all the good things that you send me." You know, yeah, it's Job. Yeah, yeah. That, you know, Aaron Sorkin's an absolute genius.
Oh gosh, and to speak those words that he
wrote, unbelievable. And I remember doing that in the cathedral, and the people that worked there were very disturbed at what I was doing, and they were absolutely. Shocked when I lit the cigarette and then stomped it out in the sanctuary. Oh, my, they couldn't abide that. And I had to explain to them, you know, that this is Job. This is a modern Job. And they got it, and they were very supportive. So
I can see some themes here that we're developing between these three movies.
Every time we get close
movies.
To filming in a famous cathedral, we have to present the script for clearance. Yeah.
We have just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye. But if Emilio, let me go back to you. And are you still acting? I know that you were part of the – I hate this phrase, but nonetheless.
But you'll say it anyway.
I'm going to say it anyway because people will know what I'm talking about, this, you know, the Brat Pack.
Right.
And so you still do act.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, I'm writing the next – well, I may have written this one for Martin. I've written the next one for myself.
Oh, you have?
Right,
ooh.
Yeah. I'm gonna get back into the – deep end of the pool and do double duty.
And this film is dedicated to your
My
grandfather.
Right, Francisco Estevez, whom I've had a better relationship and a real relationship now, 30 years after his passing.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, real connection to him.
And we should say that you also grow, I guess your grandfather,
he was a
gardener.
That's right,
he made
his own wine, grew his own grapes, he was a farmer. And I
you had to be in that isolated
right,
area.
It was very, very isolated. But I live very much like a Gallego, like a Spaniard back in California. I grow probably 50% of my own food and raise chickens for eggs and honey. We have bees for honey and worms. So, yeah, I love it. I love being outdoors. I can't wait to get home, get my hands back in the soil.
That was my interview with Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez, who joined me in 2011 to discuss their film, The Way. And that wraps up the Fathers and Sons edition of Radio Times in Review. Thanks for joining us. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits the show with help from our intern, Diana Allen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.